I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. School reopened this week in Haiti. At least those classrooms that hadn't been completely looted or destroyed over the last couple of months were open to students again. One young man in the town of Croix des Bouquets near Port-au-Prince found that vandals had even stolen the walls of his school. There was nothing left but the foundation. It is the kind of life-altering change that is more the norm in Haiti than most places in the world. Nothing seems to last, not the schools, nor the police, nor the presidents. It is this life of adapting to violent change that's at the center of a new novel by Edwige Dantica. She's a Haitian-American. Her new story is called The Dewbreaker, named after those nighttime raiders, the security forces, who used to come so late or so early in the morning that it's their feet breaking the dew in the grass. This story explores what it's like to live with and near the men who at one time took part in that violence. It helps us understand what's said and what's not. "Those nightmares you were always having," asks a daughter, "what were they?" "Of what I," he says, "your father did to others." We'd like you to join our conversation. To what extent are all Haitians prisoners of their pasts? And to what extent can a writer help all of us understand how it is that families, mothers, fathers, and children, cope with the secrets of a past that can be so violent? Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. My guest is the writer Edwige Dantica. Her new book is, as I said, called The Dewbreaker. Welcome to the studio.
Thank you for having me.
Nice to have you here. Now, you do get back and forth to Haiti fairly often, right?
But
you call America home.
Well, I call America one home. I think once you've gone through the process of leaving a place, you know, the place where you were born, as I did when I was 12, then it's easier to just adapt to different places. So this is one home. And Haiti's also home, if not a daily, everyday home, but a kind of spiritual home. I still have quite a bit of family there. So I go back as often as I can.
The family, that's it. Do you stay with the family when you're there?
I stay sometime with the family and I stay with friends. My family mostly, you know, originally come from the rural area. So we sort of have drifted from our rural place. So my family's pretty scattered in general now. And I have family all over the world, but I have family all over Haiti as well. So I stay with different family and then what I call new family, you know, friends that I have there as well.
You said you left when you were 12. Those first 12 years seem to have left such a deep impression on you that you get to keep going back to that well for your storytelling.
Well, for me, it's truly a way, in both beautiful ways and in painful ways, to go back home. You know, when I came here in 1981 at 12 years old, you know, my parents had decided that we weren't going to go back for a while. And when I started reading and writing about Haiti, that was the only way I could go back. So it's a way to go back. And as soon as I was able to go, I went and I kind of traveled and saw places that I hadn't seen there when I was a child. So yeah, those 12 years, I guess, because I didn't choose my migration, because, you know, I was just there one day and my parents sent for me, who were already here. So I think that aspect of it is that I'm always drawn back there because I felt in some way like I guess a lot of people feel who come here much older than me, that I was plucked from there. So I really treasure everything that I experienced there and everything that I had there, you know, good or bad, and that because I felt like it was something that was ending and that my years there were going to stay the same and that my years in the U.S. were going to add on. So it was just something that, it was my time capsule and just myself. It was something, a kind of preservation for me.
I was going to ask you if your mother and father left for political reasons, felt like they had to leave Haiti. But I'm wondering, you know, if somebody just leaves for a better job, isn't that the same sort of thing? I mean, there's so many reasons that people will have, are there not, for wanting to leave Haiti?
Well, I had other family members who were much younger than my parents at that time who left for political reasons, who had been in groups and sort of left really in a hurry. But my parents, my father left for, you know, for a better life, for economic reasons, and then my mother followed him. But, you know, whether, as we're seeing most recently, you know, the economics and the political are very much tied. You know, it's all linked, and that we have that debate all the time, you know, with the refugee situation in Miami, and people who are fleeing for political reasons, and it sort of diminished their flight by saying that it's an economic flight and so forth. But it in many ways, it's all very connected.
The book's just out. I know a number of people listening to us won't have had a chance to read it, but so probably fair to say, for their benefit, that what you do in the book is you take us back and forth from Haiti to life in America, in a way exploring that ugly little bit of Haiti's past, where some people got involved in violence, left to try and avoid that or make a new life. And so you create this dynamic of Haitians living in America and wondering what the other Haitians living in America did before they left. Do you know what I mean?
Well, I think on some level it's a particular dynamic, but it's not a unique one. And that, you know, for example, in that wonderful book about the Rwandan genocide, we wish to inform you that tomorrow, or, you know, the very long title, but where that book, you know, talks about, say, you know, people who were perpetrators of violence there living in Scarsdale, New York, and other, you know, and other such cases that we've had before. And in this case, you know, I was very interested in this period in Haitian history that this book covers, which is about of the tail end of the Duvalier dictatorship, because that was my very last exposure, really my constant time of living in Haiti. So it was a time that I've always wanted to explore in writing, and this idea that in migration, you know, when people come here, you know, not only the people, not the people who make it are not of one ilk, let's say, you know, it's not only the people who are fleeing, but sometimes the people they are fleeing also flee them. So in a more artistic sense, you know, less sort of literal sense, was trying to explore this idea of what flight means, you know, what all the rebirths that we go through in migration, you know, that people think sometimes when you come here, you know, you're just, you know, that your life starts in a different way. But there are many rebirths. There are many sort of sorts of definitions that people go through once they arrive here.
But what struck me, I think, more than anything else, not having made that kind of transition myself, is that your characters seem to be watching all the time. You have a woman in a Christmas mass in the church. She looks across the aisle and she sees Emmanuel, what's his last name?
Constant.
Yeah, Emmanuel Constant. Constant. Mm-hmm. Who she says, that's him. And it left me wondering, does that happen? Are people always kind of watching? Do I know that person? Do I remember that person from another time in another place?
I think that might have happened more and more as it happens in this particular story, where they think they see this person in an earlier time. But the story of Emmanuel Constant, actually, the way that sort of the appearance of Emmanuel Constant makes his way into this book is that, you know, Emmanuel Constant was the head of an organization named FRAP, which was an organization that, by his own account, was started by the CIA in Haiti during in the 1990s. And when he came here, was about to be deported back to Haiti, and has been tried in absentia, but went on 60 Minutes and basically said, you know, like, you know, I'm sort of this creation of these people. And he was selling real estate in Queens. And people would, you know, demonstrate in front of his house. But I was always struck that people would say, oh, you know, we saw Emmanuel Constant at this party or at this art gallery. So in that case, you know, they're like these famous, there's some famous ones that people can point to. But I was also interested in the ones that you can't recognize, you know, because this dictatorship was 29 years. So there are many people who participated willingly or not in this situation. And so this idea of, you know, there are some that probably are seeking redemption. There are some that, you know, acted along, but, you know, exploring all the nuances of that.
And one of the reviewers wrote about your writing that I borrowed it at the introduction of the program, that in a way everybody then ends up a prisoner of the past, whether you are a perpetrator or a victim of the violence, you end up somehow captive of that. Do you buy that?
Maybe I buy a sort of more complicated version of it. I think we're all bearers of the past in some way. You know, we have a proverb that says the one who gives the blow may forget, but the one who carries the scars remember. And I'm interested in the way that we all give blows and that we all carry scars. And so in some ways, I think we're all, if not prisoners of the past, but sort of the inheritors of it, definitely. You know, we sort of inherit the past in a way that we do with as we please. But it, you know, it behooves us to remember certain things. And and this is a point that sort of the main character makes in his own way, that even he has the most, you know, the Dewbreaker, this person who was once a torturer, he has the most to lose in having the past come up again, but feels like it's, you can't bury it, or you can't really, we can't afford to forget it. And we can't afford to forget, like, the good past, you know, or, for example, the fact that this is the 200-year anniversary of Haitian independence, and that along with sort of all the nightmarish thing, that we've also done triumphant things and wonderful things, which is also part of this past. So
it's nice to hear you say that, because we've spent so much time in the last 3 months going, 200 years, and look where the country is now. Can I ask you to introduce us to this character? Just read us the opening of the Dewbreaker chapter in the book when we first meet our character.
Well, this section is set around 1967, and the Dewbreaker, who is not named in the book, has the task of he's been assigned this task of taking out this preacher, and he's standing outside the house waiting for the preacher. He came to kill the preacher, so he arrived early, extra early, a whole 2 hours before the evening service would begin. The sun had not yet set when he plowed his black DKW within a few inches of a row of vendors who had lined themselves along where he'd imagined the curb might be to sell all kinds of things, from grilled peanuts to packs of cigarettes. He wanted a perfect view of the church entrance in case the opportunity came to do the job from inside his car without his having to get out and soil his shoes. Catching the sweet merchant stealing glimpses at his Ellenfinton frame, he shifted now and again to better fit between the car seat and the steering wheel, his wide belly spilling over his belt to touch the tip of his gear shift. Later, one of the women who didn't want her name used would tell the human rights people, "He looked like a pig in a calabash sitting there. Yes, I watched him. I watched him for a long time. I tried to frighten him with my old eyes. I belonged to that church, and I did not want to see my pastor die."
It said Reach Dantica, reading from her new book, The Dewbreaker. The art in it is that you actually end up making us care about this man.
Well, I think it's dangerous to simplify these people, you know, or to say that, you know, they're so bad that it's just sort of beyond category. And more interesting, I think as a fiction writer, you know, I have that liberty to allow some nuance and sort of, I think these people have layers and very complicated ones, and it's important to try to explore that. And for example, I mean, this preacher, you know, when I was very young, the preacher who baptized me, who was a Baptist minister named Pastor Nere, was someone who was attacked in the similar way that this preacher is in this book. So the book not only draws from different people to create the Dewbreaker, but also from just pieces of events.
Reach Dandekat is my guest. We're talking about her new book, The Dewbreaker. Is there more room for nuance in fiction, even when you're dealing with experiences that were well felt and heartfelt? Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Edwige Tantikat is here with me in our Boston studio. She's the author of a number of books: Breath, Eyes, Memory, Crick Crack, a National Book Award finalist, and The Farming of Bones, an American Book Award winner. She's going to win some prizes for her new book, The Dewbreaker, which has received rave reviews from almost everybody who's had a chance to look at it. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We'd like you to join our conversation. We're talking about whether or not Haitians are prisoners of the past, or, as Edwige says, are things a little bit more complicated, a little bit more nuanced than that. When you do take these times that were so real to you and so many other people and put them in a fictional context, it gives you all kinds of liberty not to mess with the truth, but to frame it in ways that are different and allow us those different looks at it, right?
Well, I think, you know, on some level, fiction allows you to tell greater truths, and that you can look at different sides of something and explore different possibilities. I mean, I think, you know, Haitian events in their own are very dramatic. You know, they sort of offer these twists that are very unpredictable. The history is very dramatic, you know, starting with the way the country began in 1804 and the battles. I mean, it's epic on some level. It's the minutiae that's sometimes harder, you know, just finding these smaller stories and knowing that they have to stand side by side with these enormous events. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the challenge. That's the challenge, perhaps of history, of current history, you know, looking at past history, but also that's the challenge of fiction, and that every time you write something and you think of, you know, there's a parallel reality that's even greater and more epic and more extraordinary. And that's why I try to concentrate when I write on the characters, on the people, and sort of they are walking side by side with history. They are interacting with history, but they also exist the way I do in my daily life and everybody else does as individuals, as people who bear the weight of this history, but who also bear the weight of having to create a future.
And the separation, too, that exists when there are so many Haitians who are figuring out their future in America rather than figuring out their future in Haiti. That's a large part of it, certainly in your own life.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think we all have, you know, just all Haitian families have these kind of tentacles, you know. And, for example, you know, last year when my aunt passed away, we had to wait for something like, you know, 8 days for everybody to gather from the different places that
was this the woman who raised you when
you
were very
small? The woman who raised me, yeah. She died when she was 81 years old last year. Had a very good and long life. We, you know, loved her very much.
She wasn't Estine, was she?
No, she wasn't. Actually, that was another aunt. But that actually, my aunt Estine was an aunt who lived in the country. Never was the one person in our family who never left the mountains, the Morne, you know, just stayed there, and we would have to travel 10 hours on foot to see her. That was sort of her lesson to everybody who had migrated.
There's a moment in your story, the one called Water Child, where the nurse Nadine is carrying this letter around with her, and I got this kind of flash when I was reading it, knowing as I did that you had grown up apart from your parents, and thinking to myself, only someone who had ever treasured a letter so much that it actually falls apart in her pocket, you know, can put that into the story. Was I close with that one?
Oh, that was very close. Actually, I wrote something about that a couple of years ago, and having to write to my parents. That was before, also, you know, they were here. We were separated 8 years, you know, because of immigration. They had to prove they could support us and so forth. And telephones, you know, we had to go on Sundays to the telephone office downtown in our best clothes to talk to them for a couple of minutes. And the rest of the time, that, you know, they would send us money through letters. And I had a struggle with my letters to my parents because they were very formulaic. And a lot of Haitians, if our listener will know this, you will say, you know, chère maman, dear maman, comment vas-tu, tout va bien, grâce à Dieu, you know. And so I could never...
Almost like a school exercise
exactly,
rather than a...
Exactly, you know, all is well, thank goodness. And it was... And I was frustrated, like later looking back, and I was very frustrated that there were so many things I wanted to tell them I couldn't tell them in the letters because, you know, of course, my uncle was going to read them and correct my grammar. So there was this whole sort of correspondence in between the lines. So definitely I've had that experience of just exchanging words that way. You know, any kind of, when you're separated that way from your family, you know, any kind of communication. You know, my mother sent me a dress. I rejoiced because she would make me clothes like a little size bigger from here and send them to me in Haiti. So it was, I mean, all those things, you treasure them very much, like the minutiae, that's like the details of everyday life.
Did the word then gain power for you when maybe you were really small? I mean, a lot of us didn't really get lit up about the impact of words until we were reading, you know, old enough to be reading novels. But it sounds like even a one-page letter, the words on that had great import for you.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, also, you know, I had the great luck because that, and people may not know this too in this country, like at least in my time in Haiti, my mother took me to school when I was 3 years old. So I was, you know, it's like as soon as you could walk and I was reading. By the time I was four and a half, I was already reading. And so I became a kind of, you know, I would read grown-up letters to them. So it was sort of this intrusion on the word. I just learned that very early. And also,
it's like the precocious little child who plays the piano at age three.
Well, but it was tricky because you were supposed to read all these very adult you know, material and pretend you'd never read it. So there was that filter of just learning so much about people's very private thoughts because they would need a letter written to somebody or they would need, right, a letter read. And then pretending once you step out of this space that you didn't, you never saw that. And also I just heard also a lot of stories. I was told a lot of stories, just that we have still a very strong storytelling tradition, which I relished in because I was, I was very shy. I didn't want to tell stories, but I just loved listening to stories. So there were many ways that sort of the word was connected to me, and I just felt its importance very, very early, and I'm very lucky, I guess, for that.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. My guest is Edwige Dantica. We're talking about her new book. It's called The Dewbreaker. Let's, if we can, take our first call, line from Boston, Massachusetts, and Miriam's joining us. Hi, Miriam.
Hi. Hi, Edwige.
Hi.
I just wanted to tell you, I don't have a question or anything, but I've read a few of your books, and to me, just like you said at the beginning of the show, it's like returning back home, because everything is just so real. The way you paint a picture of Haitian life is so real to me. And although we haven't shared necessarily the same experience, but to me it's life in Haiti. And I just wanted to tell you that.
Oh, thank you, Miriam. I appreciate that.
Postcards, Miriam. Like postcards, yes, from home, maybe.
Yes, exactly, exactly. And every time, like, I read your book on Jack Mel, and I was like, gosh, I want to be there right now.
Oh. Well, you know, they're having a great film festival in the summer in Jack Mel, so try to get there then. We hope people will be able to go more then.
Yes, I definitely plan on doing that.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for calling.
Thanks, Miriam. 1-800-423-8255. Let's take our next call, if we can, from Everett, Massachusetts. Martin's with us. Hi, Martin.
Hi. How are you doing, Edward?
Hello, Martin.
Yeah. Dick, I want to thank you, too, because you've been giving us Haitian opportunities to know that there's, like, some great Haitians out there that we didn't even know about.
Not hard to find, I can tell you that, Martin.
Yeah, I think that I didn't have a chance to read Edwidge's book. I think I might have a chance to buy it, but I'm looking forward to do that. But I think, like, the way she's been talking about Haitian being prisoner of our past, I think it is so obvious that we Haitian, we tend to wondering whether or not we will have a future. So I think that problem, basically, we've been having so many political unrest in Haiti. Anytime we have something that somebody tell us that is going to happen, we kind of wondering whether or not it is not going to be the same old thing we've been seeing over and over again. So, Hedridge, my question for you, Willie, is what do you think as Haitian we should do in order, like, to think we're not going to, you know, stay and build, I mean, living our past over and over again, and then try to think more, like, in the future what we can do in order to improve life in Haiti?
Well, I mean, I think we, the first thing is to not go with this assumption that we don't have a future. I mean, we have a future no matter what, whether, you know, it's going to be a better future than, you know, or a terrible future. We'll definitely have to have a future. You know, we have a country, we have a generation coming up, you know. So I think first we have to assume that we have a future and work towards that future. Now there's some organizations, there's some wonderful people struggling and working in Haiti. A lot of people who go back and work in their home places, hometowns or villages. These small projects that sometimes go, under the radar, But that's one way that we here can participate, you know, with schools and things that concentrate on that future with the children. If you find an organization that works in a small way, that you don't have to be in government or you don't have to be large to do something to help people, I think.
But do you really think it's all depending on us, or we should get advice from, you know, the international community, as they've been involved a lot in Haiti in what has been happening so far to us? Hence our, you know, the beginning of our history.
Well, I don't think we can, I don't think the international community as such, if that's like the only people we're depending on, have always had our best interest at heart. I mean, I'm skeptical of sort of why the French are there 200 years after independence. And they've always, I mean, I think they've interfered or intervened when faced with their own interests. So I'm assuming that the people who are listening to me are here or people who care about Haiti or Haitian Americans, you know, take the responsibility on your own, what you can do individually. But I think, you know, we've had 3 U.S. interventions, and if they wanted to do something really long-term, that would have already been done.
You were last there a couple of months ago, is that right?
Yes, I was there over after Christmas through early January, just to be there, just to be on the soil for the 200 year anniversary. I wanted to be. I'd been planning for months, you know, with my husband to be there on January 1st. So we were there. We wanted to go just to mountains. We wanted to go to water. So we went to the countryside and sort of were just to be there.
How was it?
It was. I mean, you know, things were.
Starting to
we're
get
just
a little
starting,
edgy. Yeah.
You know, there were demonstrations in Port-au-Prince and some of the cities, but they hadn't, you know, that whole rebel formula, those super armed men who mysteriously came across the border hadn't arrived yet. So we went to certain places that we'd always want to go. There's a beautiful waterfall out south in a place called Campingue, and we went to that. I mean, there's some gorgeous places in Haiti, you know, that I think if only people could get to. There's some just wonderful places to be, but you don't get a chance to with all that goes on.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. 1-800-423-8255. Edwige Dantica is my guest. We're talking about her new book, The New Breaker, and other aspects of being Haitian American. Let's go next to Ashland, Massachusetts, and Milan's joining us. Hi, Milan.
Hello. It's a pleasure to be talking with you, because it's been a while since in the talking about Haiti, I've been trying to get in with no luck. I just have a question and a comment, and the question is, I would like for Edwige to speak a little about the title of the book, The Dew Breaker. I've read some of her exquisite writings, and I would like to hear how she come along with that specific title. And the comment, the second one is a comment, and I believe that in some ways that we are all prisoners of the past. And for depend of what the past has been for specific individuals, we certainly have to bear the weight of whatever that past has brought to us. At times, I think about the issues of African Americans living here and how difficult and impossible it is for them to break out of the heritage of their past here. So it's extremely difficult. So in that way, if the past has been heavy and difficult and painful for individuals, we are certainly going to be prisoners of it for a while, unless there are people who work genuinely, constantly, very hard at breaking those shackles, those tentacles that Edwige was referring to earlier. So for now, I will just bring it to listening to the Dew Breaker, how she came with that title.
Mm. Well, thank you, Milan. I think she makes an exquisite point, like a very good point, in the sense that, you know, you think of lift every voice and sing. It says sing a song full of the hope that the present is, you know, the dark past has wrought us. And so the past is definitely the sort of the shadow that follows us around. And linking to the past, also the title of the book, The title, The Dewbreaker, is my translation of an expression called Chouquette Laouze. And a Chouquette Laouze was a person.
Creole, right?
It's a Creole. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's a person who often in a rural area was the single legal authority in that area. So there was a, what we would say, a chef section, or someone who was affiliated with the regime, you know, with the Duvalier regime, but it was sort of terrorized people, could do whatever he wanted in that place.
Was the police chief and the chief judge and everything
all
rolled
into
one, right?
Judge and everything.
Yeah.
And so this one very powerful person, you know, just had that title referred to this person who was in the country. But this main character here works in the city, and it's sort of a tribute to his cruelty, a kind of a reference to his cruelty, that he's acting exactly like the people who are in the country who are considered a little bit more cruel. And so that's where that title comes from. It also echoes and is in conversation with a great Haitian novel called Gouverneur de la Osée, Masters of the Dew, by a great Haitian writer named Jacques Romain, who's one of our greatest. And his book, Masters of the Dew, was translated into English by Langston Hughes and Mercer Cook in the 1940s. And the whole premise of the book is this: a man who comes back from Cuba to take over his sort of family land in a small village, and there's a drought in the village. And he's helping them find the dew, basically find this source of water that will bring lushness and everything to this area. And so his whole, you know, Jacques Woman's whole premise with the dew is that if we master the dew, you know, we can master our destinies. So I think you just, in a way, that our history has been a struggle between the masters of the dew and the dew breakers. So that book, I hope, is in a kind of a conversation with his book.
Milan, thanks a lot for that call. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. My guest this hour, Edwige Dantica. We're talking about her new book, and we were just talking about the title. It's called The Dew Breaker. We're interested in having you join us, 1-800-423-TALK, on connections between the past and the present and the place of fiction in helping us better understand those. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. My guest this hour is Edwige Dantica. We're talking about her new book, The Dew Breaker. My name's Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. And our telephone number, if you'd like to join us, is 1-800-423-8255. And it sort of seems like a good opportunity to take the idea of the Chouquette Laouzée a little bit further and have you show us where this popped into a story. This one is the bridal seamstress. I sort of have a soft spot for this because there's a reporter in there trying to get a story, but that has nothing to do. What's going on in the story? Just tell us.
Well, the bridal seamstress, we have Aline, who's a young reporter sort of just interning, who's actually from Massachusetts. She's from Somerville and ends up in New York, right, interning at this Haitian-American startup newspaper. And she's asked to interview this bridal seamstress, this woman who makes wedding dresses but takes her job very seriously. And come to find out, because the bridal seamstress is retiring, and when she interviews the bridal seamstress, then she starts talking about a man who moves into every house she moves into when she goes into a new neighborhood. So she's been moving pretty much since she came to this country, trying to escape this man who she cannot really escape. So she's at this point giving a present to the reporter and explaining her past. Beatrice put the thimble back in the box, then set the whole kit down on the ground. She covered her eyes with both hands, then gradually moved her fingers as though to slowly take in the world again. "We call them Chouquette Laouzée," Beatrice said, the couch's plastic cover squeaking beneath her. "They'd break into your house, mostly it was at night, but often they'd also come before dawn as the dew was settling on the leaves, and they'd take you away. He was one of them, the guard." Beatrice removed her open-toed sandals and raised her feet so Aline could see the soles of her feet. They were thin and sheer, like an albino baby's skin. "He asked me to go dancing with him one night," Beatrice said, putting her feet back in her sandals. "I had a boyfriend, so I said no. That's why he arrested me." He tied me to some type of rack in the prison and whipped the bottom of my feet until they bled. Then he made me walk home barefoot on tar roads in the hot sun at high noon. This man, whenever I rent a house or buy one, I find him living on my street. Beatriz got up and collected the empty coffee cups, piling them on one tray. Aline reached over to help her, but Beatriz gently pushed her hands away. It was the inevitable question, maybe insulting, but Aline felt she had to ask it. Are you sure it's the same person? Beatriz removed her bronze wig, revealing a line of cotton-white cornrows curved towards the back of her neck. She raised her hand to her head and scratched her scalp, as though to quell the flame there. You never look at anyone the way you do someone like this. Beatrice's exasperation was spewing out with the spittle at the side of her mouth. No one will ever have that much of your attention. No matter how much he'd change, I would know him anywhere.
That's Edwidge Dantica reading from her new book, The Dew Breaker. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. Back to the phone lines to Providence, Rhode Island, and Manuela's joining us. Hi, Manuela.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call, and also thank you to Edwidge, like in the words of my father, for the ones that haven't forgotten. As a Haitian-American that left Haiti like in 1986, and also with a younger sibling born in this country, I was wondering if you can talk about, I think, the younger generations of Haitian-Americans that necessarily have an uncomfortable position with the past and how they negotiate their own identity with the future of Haiti.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a whole fascinating generation, because I've watched, I have two brothers in my family. There are two of us who were born in Haiti and the two of us who were born here. So we were just sort of this split down the middle in terms of places. And I've watched my brothers come of age and watched this whole, you know, generation also coming up. And when you think about it, I mean, I'm part of a first generation that is calling itself Haitian American in a way. I mean, in a consistent way, in large numbers, because say my parents would consider themselves Haitian, and then my brothers were born here, you know, because it was always a debate in our house, you know, you're not so American, but also implying in that statement that they were American. So there's this generation that's kind of building that. And I often say that I feel like I'm writing to this generation, because, There's so many of us who may not necessarily speak French, may not necessarily speak or read Creole, but is growing up in this culture that's very interested in Haiti, but who has this sort of dual vision of Haiti and the nostalgia of our parents, you know, who see Haiti as this paradise, you know, who remember the good old days and so forth, but in the horror of the news media, you know, sort of you're seeing this dual sense of the country. And I'm encouraged by so many of them who long to go there, who long to be. And I used to be part of this program that used to go with younger people to Haiti, and they travel around the country. And they're awestruck by it. You know, they're just like the whole discovery. It's like something that's familiar, yet, you know, that you never knew before. And so that's, I have a lot of hope for this generation. I have a lot of hope for the way they defined also their place here and the things that the contributions that they'll be making, not only to our community back home, but also to the community here. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them, you know, we sort of have to go out there and sort of reclaim them, because a lot of them blend in the larger community. But I think it's important, you know, as Emmanuel is saying, to let them know that we want them and that we're proud of them and that we want them in this community, that we need them.
On them to be more American, less Haitian, because they're born in America?
Well, I think, you know, it depends. They're sort of getting both. I mean, I don't think it's necessarily like the culture clash, necessarily that sort of easy dichotomy. But, you know, they have a life here. They know a life here, but they also they know the Haiti of their parents through memories and so forth. So I think what's also interesting is to see how ways that they could still, you know, they could contribute to the community, and so that they don't leave us completely, but they still are able to live individual lives and pursue their dreams, but still in some ways, you know, we can claim them for the community.
How's that, Manuela?
No, it's great. I mean, I also think, too, though, that I think that with the younger generation, there's a sort of a real-life material, I think, reality that comes in, that when you have a country, for example, that is currently in such a political, I guess, problems, so to say, is that For the ones that do want to go back, though, but yet though they're frightened off
because
of the real threat of violence. So then what exactly does that mean when you have this community that's more or less living abroad often and their own fears of coming back and how they make this sort of homeland, but it's so divorced from the actual like realities of Haiti and what goes on?
Well, I think we have to, we don't have to reinvent this wheel. I mean, I think there are the examples of other communities that have managed to, you know, build some kind of power base here that in some ways can influence policy back home, that can make some contributions back home. I know I know your frustration because often when I'm on campuses, you know, I meet young people who say, you know, I want to go back, I want to do this, but there are obstacles to them going back in a way that, it, you know, they're not sure how to go back in a way that is safe, that will be, you know, productive and efficient. But there are a lot of organizations that you can research and make sure are right with you and your values, or just finding ways also that you can contribute whether you're here or whether you're able to go or not, I think is a good way to sort of try to balance it.
Manuela, thanks a lot for that call. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Westboro, Massachusetts, and Hervé is joining us. Hervé, thanks for calling.
Yes, hi. How you doing?
I'm well, and you?
Well, I'm doing okay. I'm kind of glad that you have her on the radio because when she read that story, it kind of brought me back because my father was a preacher, and he was chased out of Haiti.
Mm-hmm.
Did you leave with him, Hervé, or were you born here?
Actually, we were left behind.
Ah, okay.
I stayed in Haiti probably another 7 or 8 years since my father left.
This is
wow, just
starting
like
to sound
me.
Very
yeah.
familiar.
Yeah.
Yeah, and what happened is, I guess the people that were going after him eventually came to look for us. And our aunt, my aunt, my mother, and everything had left. We were the only people left behind, and eventually they sent for us.
How old were you when you came to America, Hervé?
Probably around 9 or 10.
And your memories of Haiti, do you miss the country?
I miss it greatly. I really do miss it. Because I don't know if she feels like that. I feel like I'm a stranger in a different land. Because my memory of Haiti was not that it was bad. Maybe because I was so young and I didn't know.
That's what Edge Reach was saying, that we focus always on the bad because it's in the news.
Yeah. And my memories of Haiti is that it was great. It was awesome. I had a lot of fun there. Yes, there were some scary times when these people were chasing after us and trying to get to us because they wanted to get to my father. But still, it is my home. And I don't know how else to explain that to anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering, would she comment on that?
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio.
Well, I think, you know, that's what's extraordinary, too, about the power of Haiti that people don't often get is that even if you listen to Hervé speaking, he's like, yeah, people were chasing us around. But he loved it. Like, how incredible is that? And it is something that you don't grasp unless you've been to Haiti, and that you're willing, like, whether, you know, people are willing to sort of sacrifice certain discomforts to be there. I mean, there's something very sort of amazing about that just that statement that he made, that just I find extraordinary.
In the book, The Dewbreaker, one of the things that you use to help us understand the old identity and the new identity are those things that we understand hide identity, like masks, and even the sculpture that the woman does of her father, which he doesn't really like because it either reminds him too much of whenever. Is part of what you're saying that you think it's important for Haitian Americans or even Haitians just to lose the masks and to lose those things that mask their identity, to be, to sort of, I'm struggling a bit for a way of finding the word. You're the wordsmith here. What's my question? My question is, get away from the masks and just be more who you are.
But we are who we are. I mean, I think, and sometimes are
But are you? Because what you're saying is a lot of people do live kind of hidden lives, or they're not talking about their past. You know what I mean?
Well, I mean, I think we have to look at different aspects or different moments. culturally, I mean, are we who we are with these beautiful paintings? I mean, we express, there's sort of a very open and wonderful different experiences, different cultural expressions. So that's also who we are. But we also, you know, we're these people who also fought the revolution. And yes, we're also the people who went through the recent experiences. We're all that. We're all that. And it's like Paul Laurence, you know, the Lawrence Dunbar poem, We Wear the Masks. And that's, I think that's true of all people, you know. So we are all that. You know, I think that that's where the complication, that's where the nuances come in. We're good, we're bad, we're, you know, we're impatient. We're, so we're all of that, just as all people are. I don't know that that solution is. I mean, I think that probably there's hope. I seek hope, and sort of the motto of the country, the creed of the country, is that in unity there is strength. If we can all some, find some way to sort of move closer to the common good on some level, as opposed to sort of individual and specific interest, then maybe we'll get closer to unmasking. You know?
You're reminding me of one thing I wanted to ask you, and that's just about the epigram of the book. You choose a piece of a Mandelstam poem. Maybe this is the beginning of madness. Forgive me for what I'm saying. Read it quietly, quietly. This is a really unhappy man writing poetry during the time of Stalin. And I'm thinking to myself, oh, she's so depressed about it. But you, I think, chose it for a different reason.
Yes, I chose it for the quiet, in the sense that, you know, there's some quiet acts that can be transgressed, and reading might be one of them. So it was, I imagined people reading this maybe under the dictatorship as they were, you know, quietly reading a lot of our other wonderful writers who were killed or exiled during that time. So I chose that just to sort of set the mood for that, like read it quietly, quietly, you know, and then think about it and read some more.
I want to thank you so much for coming in. It's been a pleasure having you here.
Thank you for having me.
Edwidge Dandekat, author of The Dewbreaker. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.